Welcome to the first installment of Sedgwick Institute Live, where I'll profile influential thought leaders to make a difference and whose interests lie in the risk and insurance world. I'm Chris Mandel, director of the newly established Sedgwick Institute, and my guest today is Dr. Richard Victor, founder and head of the Workers' Comp Research Institute and the first senior fellow of the Sedgwick Institute. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning, Chris.
So, Rick, let's start off this conversation with the personal stuff. Tell me about your family and maybe a personal interest of yours.
Well, I'm very proud of my wife, Marlon, who's been a great partner, raised two terrific young men, piloted our household, and did all of that while being fully engaged in the practice of law. Our son, Dan, will finish his degree in theater this month. He wants to be a director and actor. He just began a job search, so if any of the listeners have any ideas, feel free to email me. And our son, Matt, graduated from the business school at Syracuse last year, and he works for a large strategy consulting firm in the healthcare practice.
Now, you're based in Boston now. Have you been there, I guess, most of your career anyway, right?
I've been in Boston since 1983.
Very good. Now let's turn to who you are so that the listeners can get a sense of that. Tell me about your life before the Workers' Comp Research Institute.
I grew up in the Detroit suburbs. My father had a community pharmacy, and from the time I was 12, I worked there every Saturday and every summer until I went to college. I went to the University of Michigan during the Vietnam protest years. Then I reenlisted at Michigan for law school and also along the way, picked up a Ph.D. in economics. After graduate school, I went to the RAND Corporation. RAND is the nation's first think tank on public policy issues, and from my perspective, the best place to learn how to do public policy analysis and the best place to do public policy research. In 1983, I founded WCRI and moved from the beach of Santa Monica, California, to Boston, where the weather's not quite as good.
Now, I don't know about the wisdom of that last part. You know, I know California, and I know the beaches out there, so hopefully your transition to Boston's been a good one. It obviously has, since you've been there for a long time. So, well, that's great. I know RAND, of course, is a institution, well-regarded and a great place to really get your foundation started before you went down this work comp research road. So you founded and led the WCRI for over 30 years. How did it start, and what was its purpose, and what was its status when you retired from it in 2015?
The concept that underlies WCRI dates from the late 1970s. At the time, the insurance industry was increasingly concerned that tort law was changing in unanticipated ways, and that public policy on tort issues were largely being driven by anecdotes and by raw political power. They decided that if policymakers and judges had credible data on key issues, that the resulting decisions would be better informed and ultimately more predictable. They helped to create something called the Institute for Civil Justice at RAND to be that credible source, and RAND management asked me to lead the development of the first research agenda. My reward for that work was I could choose the research area that I would end up leading. And I chose workers' compensation. Now, why would I do that? Not only did it have data I could analyze, but more importantly, workers' comp affects the lives of millions of workers every year and also the competitiveness of American business. And there wasn't a lot of workers' comp research at the time, so it was clearly an opportunity where I could make a difference. After a few years, a group of insurers and employers decided an expanded focus on workers' comp research would be useful for state policymakers, and they invited me to step out of RAND and create the Workers' Compensation Research Institute. What's the status of WCRI when I retired at the end of last year? Terrific. Terrific group of highly motivated, very smart, very creative colleagues. A terrific database that they have access to, a board of directors that has been a guiding star, and reinforcing to me and to my colleagues at the Institute about the importance of doing independent, credible work. And the Institute's current leadership, Ramona Tanabe, who's been there for 20 years, and I used to joke that I was just decorative, that she actually did it, got all the work done. And my successor, Dr. John Reuser, who came from the federal government, I think aren't missing a beat.
So what are some of the major WorkComp research findings that the Institute developed in recent years that you think might have had some impact or maybe even significant impact?
Well, there's lots and lots of examples, which is what kept me there for so long. An early WCRI study is still saving California employers $250 million every year. That study led the California legislature to unanimously change. Notice I said California legislature voted unanimously. May have been the last time. To change the way med legal experts are paid. The bill sponsor felt that the Institute's work was so important to that change that he sent us a copy, a framed copy of the three-page bill with an original signature from Governor Pete Wilson, and that still hangs in the entryway at WCRI. Another example, when Texas first debated reforms, systemic reforms, WCRI research helped to frame the debate. At the time, the Dallas Morning News, wrote an editorial that began, "It's well known that Texas employers pay high costs and workers get poorer outcomes." And then they called for a change. That well-known set of facts came directly from WCRI research. More recently, Institute studies on opioid use contributed to the larger debate crisis, and the information has been used in many states to focus policymakers on opportunities for solutions. And most recently, the work on physician dispensing. A series of studies done by WCRI showed that physician dispensing is not only costly, but it leads to unnecessary opioid prescriptions. This is the subject of a forthcoming paper that I'll release on the Sedgwick Institute website next month.
Very good. Just as an aside, opioid abuse and the contribution that the claim service world can make to helping solve that problem is a high priority of the Institute's agenda. And we'll be doing some work with third parties on that coming soon. You know, one thing you told me a while ago that I, being new to the research world, I found pretty interesting was your initiatives were such that the final product didn't necessarily or didn't make recommendations. It was an attempt, and a good one, to remain objective in order to, you know, maintain credibility and use objective facts to influence policy debates. That's really the best paradigm for any institute to operate under, I guess. Would you agree?
Well, it certainly worked well for WCRI in being able to have an impact and earn the respect of a diverse and not always friendly group of stakeholders.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Well, you know, Rick, there's a lot of talk today about dysfunction in the work comp systems of the various states. There's been lots of reform over the last 10 to 15 years, some of it good, some of it not so good in terms of effect. What's your view of the state of the work comp system?
Well, dissatisfaction has occurred in the past. It almost seems cyclical. In the 1970s, it was focused on how to better serve injured workers and how to design the systems to strengthen the safety net for workers. In the 1990s, the focus was on rapidly rising costs to employers and identifying and remediating the cost drivers. In the past decade, the focus has been on rising medical costs, reducing unnecessary care, regulating medical prices. And most recently, some have raised questions about whether the current workers' comp systems are consistent with the proverbial grand bargain. And the several constitutional challenges that have been filed are manifestations of this concern. Now, what do I see in the evidence? as I wrote in a recent Sedgwick Institute blog post, workers' comp systems do a very good job for the overwhelming majority of workers, but not for all workers. And who are the workers who don't get the best outcomes? Well, some are cases that are not well handled by adjusters, by lawyers for the workers, for the payer, and by treating doctors. Some are workers whose cases raise legitimate disagreements about whether the injury is compensable, or raise public policy issues about what are the boundaries of compensability. And some are workers who have, unfortunately, characteristics that mean they're disadvantaged in the labor market or disadvantaged in accessing medical care. And this is both in workers' comp, but in general. These are workers who have lower levels of education, older workers, workers with limited English language proficiency, and workers who work in what I call low-trust environments.
Which states do you see as having the biggest opportunities for improvement, and why?
Well, that's an interesting question. It used to be, 15 years ago, that the issues, that there are a number of states where systemic reform was really what was going on. I think there are opportunities that exist in most states, but on specific issues, not really a need for systemic reform. Examples. In Florida, policymakers have to find a durable solution on how to compensate attorneys for injured workers. They now have a too long history of a law being passed, it being struck down by the court, the Supreme Court, the legislature enacting new legislation that's unsatisfactory to worker advocates, the law again being struck down by the court, and the cycle repeats. The policymakers in Florida need to find a compromise solution that the workers' attorneys and the employers can both support, however grudgingly. Or in Wisconsin, medical prices are much higher than necessary to get good doctors to treat injured workers. Or in Louisiana, exceptionally high use of opioids. 1 in 6 workers who start on opioids in Louisiana are still getting opioid prescriptions 9 months later. So I think it's issue-specific in each state.
Mm-hmm. Of course, one of the challenges of improvement is stakeholder interest, and some of them very narrow. Lots of players within the work comp system, therefore lots of stakeholders, and as you well know better than most, you know, that's probably one of the bigger challenges of making improvements when you've got to try and satisfy the major stakeholders in the process. On a related basis, then, I wonder if you have an opinion about the risk of federalization of the system in the next few years. And if you do, what do you think the key drivers for such change might be?
Well, I think if the current federal workers' comp programs are any indication, most state systems compare pretty favorably. So if there were to be some federalization of workers' comp, I would think it the federal programs wouldn't be the best model.
So you would be an advocate, I presume, then, for allowing the states to fix what's wrong with their systems and, improve the gaps, close the gaps that exist where, I guess, they're most egregious. Would that be a good assumption?
I think the states as laboratories, assuming that they perform well, makes the most sense.
Very good. The Department of Labor has been asked by a group of legislators last fall to reassert themselves into oversight, if not increased regulation, of the work comp systems. What are your thoughts about this subject and any increased role of the Department of Labor or any other federal agency in work comp system effectiveness?
Well, you know, same thing. The current federal programs, I think, don't compare to state systems, or to most state systems, in a favorable way. So I don't think that provides much objective impetus for a larger federal role in the system, as long as the state systems basically do their job and perform well for the employers on the cost side and workers on the outcome side.
Yeah, I guess the inference was that Department of Labor used to be more heavily involved in oversight of worker safety, and that that, for whatever reasons, fell on hard times over the last 10 years or so. Do you think there's any accuracy to that assertion?
That's not my impression. I think the current administration and David Michaels, the current head of OSHA, is very proactive.
I think one of the other assertions in that initiative was that there was a lot of transfer going on between work comp systems and the Social Security disability system. Did WCRI do any work in that area, or have you seen anything that would substantiate that assertion?
They have, at least as of the beginning of this year, have not yet addressed that issue. And there's not a lot that I've seen in terms of evidence. I think that's a big gap, and I think it's something that needs to be addressed. And failing having some credible objective evidence about the extent of the problem, I think it's unpredictable as to whether the feds will get involved. On the other hand, it's clear that at some point, there's a need for revenue in the Social Security Trust Fund.
Yes, indeed. We've heard all the projections about how soon it will go belly up, and we can only hope that they're inaccurate. But in any event, what are your thoughts about the state of the work comp service space and whether or not TPAs like Sedgwick and other claim professionals can play a more effective role in shepherding injured employees through the bureaucracy at Work Comp Administration?
I'm very intrigued by the emerging paradigm shift that I see in claims management toward a worker advocacy model. I think it's very intriguing, and I'm eager to see what the results look like.
Yes, and as you know, that is one of Sedgwick's latest priorities, really wanting to make sure that the employee is the priority, does get the care they need, while at the same time serving the obligations we have to their employers, our customers. There's an effort to extend variations on the Texas non-subscription system and the Oklahoma option into other states like Tennessee and South Carolina. What are your thoughts about the value of these efforts in bringing choice to employers as to how to more effectively administer employee injuries?
In concept, I find it appealing for workers and employers to negotiate an alternative to workers' comp in certain states. I think of it much like charter schools. It has the potential to stimulate innovation and performance improvement in state workers' comp systems when there is a competitor. A good example of this are the labor management carve-outs that a number of states have authorized, but it's limited to a few industries and not available in all states. My problem with the current opt-out initiatives is that the plans that are commonly used in general and on balance from studies I've seen are too often written with benefits and dispute resolution processes that are not comparable to those in the carve-outs or in state workers' comp systems. So in an arm's-length negotiation, I'd be surprised if worker advocates were likely to embrace this package, and that probably means that it's not a balanced substitute for workers' comp.
Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned the grand bargain up front, Rick, which, you know, this brings me back to reminding that maybe for anybody that doesn't know, could you go ahead and just remind everybody, what is the grand bargain that seems to be in question now?
Well, when people say the grand bargain, they mean that workers gave up their right to sue in tort when they were injured, and employers gave up basically the defense that the employer wasn't at fault, so that the fact of a work-related injury generated the obligation for compensation, and there wasn't a fight about who's at fault.
Mm-hmm. So going back to where we left off before I took that diversion, I guess, you know, I just wonder what your opinion is about employers wanting and getting more control, because in some sense that's what Texas non-subscription and option legislation is about, giving the employer more control, but not to the detriment of the injured worker. What's your thought about that?
I think there is a modest amount in most states and a sizable amount in some states of unnecessary cost in the system, and that if one could design a benefit package that and dispute resolution process that worker advocates and employer advocates were satisfied with, I think the carve-outs demonstrate that you can reduce the unnecessary costs in the system.
Mm, very good. As the first senior fellow appointed to the Cedric Institute, Rick, what are your thoughts about the Institute and the opportunity it presents for you to influence the industry post your career at WCRI?
I think the establishment of the Institute is very exciting. There's great potential for it to help policymakers and help Cedric's diverse constituencies. Personally, I feel honored and extremely lucky that Cedric management was willing to support me so that I could continue to write and speak and help policymakers on the issues that I have some expertise in. While at WCRI, you mentioned we never took positions nor made recommendations. Now I'm freed of that constraint, although by nature I'm constrained by what substantial evidence says on an issue.
Well, that's something I guess we'll be deliberating about as we move forward through the priorities that the Institute takes up. We're certainly glad to have you on board, Rick, and your intense and deep expertise in the area of work comp. So finally, you're working on two books for the Institute, and I'm wondering if you could give us an overview of what you'll be addressing in each and when they might be available to the world to read.
One of the books focuses on what a well-designed workers' compensation system looks like. The other book discusses the convergence of forces that are outside of workers' compensation that I think requires fundamental change in workers' comp systems or may even present existential threats. So stay tuned, and I'm hoping that what I'm able to write will be of sufficient interest that people other than immediate family members will be interested in reading the book.
We'll make sure of that, and I'm sure it will. Just for the benefit of the audience, the tentative plan is to release portions of these books in chapter form periodically as Rick's writing moves forward. So you won't necessarily have to wait a long time to begin to see the fruits of his insights. Well, thank you, Rick, for your time and those insights. It's been a pleasure talking to you today.
It's been a pleasure, Chris.
Yes, thank you, sir. You can find Rick and my speaking and writing schedules as well as other resources at our website, CedricInstitute.com. Please consider joining the Institute's LinkedIn group titled Cedric Institute, where we dialogue daily on issues of importance to stakeholders in the risk and insurance world. Till next month, when we'll have our second installment and monthly thereafter, I urge you to use your expertise and influence to make a difference whenever you can.